When word filtered to Greg that he needed to pay rent, he laughed and sent a message back that he would never pay a dime to anyone for living in such a rat hole. The row was ruled by Soledad, the nickname of a killer who'd once spent time in the famous prison in California. Soledad didn't appreciate Greg's pro-death penalty stance, and he really didn't like David Letterman. And since any boss worthy of respect had to be ready to kill, Greg became the target. Everyone has enemies on the row. The feuds are nasty and arise quickly over anything. A pack of cigarettes can provoke an attack in the yard or the shower. Two packs can get you killed. Greg needed a friend to watch his back. Annette's first visit to McAllister was sad and frightening, not that she was expecting anything else. She preferred not to go, but Ronnie had no one but his sisters. The guards patted her down and checked her purse. Moving through the layers of the big house was like sinking into the dark belly of a beast. Doors clanged, keys rattled, guards glared as if she had no business there. She was numb, sleepwalking, with a hard knot in her stomach and a racing pulse. They were from a nice family in a nice house on a shady street. Church on Sundays. 1,000 baseball games when Ronnie was a boy. How had it all come to this? This will become a habit, she admitted to herself. She would hear the same sounds and see the same guards many times in the future. She asked if she could bring stuff, cookies, clothes, cash. No, came the quick answer. Only small change. So she handed the guard a handful of quarters and hoped he passed them on to Ronnie. The visitation room was long and narrow and split down the center with thick sheets of plexiglass that were divided by partitions to allow some measure of privacy. All conversations were by phone through a window. No touching whatsoever. Ronnie eventually showed up. No one was in a hurry at the prison. He looked healthy, maybe even a bit chubby, but then his weight had always gone up and down dramatically. He thanked her for coming, said he was surviving okay but needed money. The food was awful, and he wanted to buy something to eat at the canteen. He also was desperate for a guitar, and some books and magazines, and a small television, which could be purchased through the canteen. "Get me out of here, Annette," he pleaded over and over. "I didn't kill Debbie Carter, and you know it." She had never wavered in her belief that he was innocent, though some family members now had doubts. She and her husband, Marlon, were both working and raising a family and trying to save a little. Money was tight. What was she supposed to do? The state-funded indigent lawyers were getting themselves organized for his appeals. "Sell your house and hire a big lawyer," he said. "Sell everything. Do anything. Just get me out." The conversation was tense, and there were tears. Another inmate arrived for a visit in the booth next to Ronnie. Annette could barely see him through the glass, but she was intrigued by who he was and whom he had killed. "Roger Dale Stafford," Ronnie told her, "the famous steakhouse murderer. He had 9 death sentences, the current record on the row. He executed 6 people, including 5 teenagers, in the rear of a steakhouse in Oklahoma City in a bungled robbery, then murdered a family of 3. "They're all killers," Ronnie kept saying. "And all they talk about is killing. It's everywhere on the row. Get me out!" "Did he feel safe?" she asked. "Hell no, not living with a bunch of killers." He had always believed in the death penalty, but now he was a diehard supporter of it. He kept such opinions quiet, though, in his new neighborhood. There were no time limits on the visits. They eventually said goodbye with sincere promises to write and call. Annette was emotionally drained when she left McAllister. The calls started immediately. On the row, they put a phone on a cart and rolled it to the cells. A guard punched the numbers, then handed the receiver through the cell door. Since all calls were collect, the guards really didn't care how often they were made. Out of boredom and desperation, Ron was soon yelling for the cart more than anyone else. He usually began by demanding money, $20 or $30, so he could eat and buy cigarettes. Annette and Renee each tried to send $40 a month, but they had their own expenses and little extra money. They never sent enough, and Ronnie reminded them of this over and over. He was often angry, claiming that they didn't love him or they would get him out. He was innocent, everybody knew it, and there was no one on the outside to free him but his sisters. The calls were rarely pleasant, though they tried not to fight with him. Ron usually managed at some point to remind his sisters how much he loved them. Annette's husband sent subscriptions to National Geographic and the Ada Evening News. Ronnie wanted to monitor things back home. Not long after his arrival at McAllister, he heard for the first time about the bizarre confession of Ricky Joe Simmons. Barney knew about the taped confession, but chose not to use it at trial and didn't tell his client. An investigator with the Indigent Defense System took the video of the confession to McAllister and showed it to Ron. He went ballistic. Someone else admitted killing Debbie Carter, and the jury never knew about it? Surely this news would soon break in Ada, and he wanted to read about it in the local paper. Ricky Joe Simmons became another obsession, perhaps the principal one, and Ron would fixate on him for many years. Ron tried to call everybody. He wanted the world to know about Ricky Joe Simmons. His confession was Ron's ticket out, and he wanted someone to step forward and bring the boy to trial. He called Barney, other lawyers, county officials, even old friends, but most refused to accept the collect charges. Rules were changed, and phone privileges were restricted after a couple of death row inmates were caught making calls to the families of their victims, just for the sport of it. On the average, two calls per week were allowed, and every phone number had to be pre-approved. Once a week, the run man pushed a cart of well-used paperback library books through F. Cell House. Greg Wilhoit read everything that was available. Biographies, mysteries, westerns. Stephen King was a favorite, but he really loved the books of John Steinbeck. He encouraged Ron to read as an escape, and they were soon debating the merits of The Grapes of Wrath and East of Eden, unusual conversations on the row. They stood for hours, leaning through the bars of their doors, talking and talking. Books, baseball, women, their trials. Both were surprised to learn that most death row inmates do not maintain their innocence. Instead, they tend to embellish their crimes when talking among themselves. Death was a constant topic. Murders, murder trials, murders yet to be committed. When Ron continued to claim he was innocent, Greg began to believe him. Every inmate has his trial transcript close by, and Greg read Ron's, all 2,000 pages. He was shocked by the trial in Ada. Ron read Greg's transcript and was equally shocked by his trial in Osage County. They believed each other and ignored the skepticism from their neighbors. In his early weeks on the row, the friendship was therapeutic for Ron. Someone finally believed him. Someone he could talk to for hours. Someone who would listen with an intelligent and sympathetic ear. Away from the cave-like cell in Ada, and able to unload on a friend, his behavior was stable. He didn't rant and pace and scream his innocence. The mood swings were not as dramatic. He slept a lot, read for hours, chain-smoked, and talked to Greg. They went to the exercise yard together, each watching the other's back. Annette sent more money, and Ron purchased a small television from the canteen. She knew how important a guitar was to Ronnie, and she relentlessly went about trying to get one. The canteen didn't stock them. After phone calls and letters, she convinced the officials to allow a local music store in McAllister to sell one and send it over. Trouble started when it arrived. Anxious to impress the others with his talent, Ron played it loudly and sang at full volume. The complaints came with a fury, but Ron didn't care. He loved his guitar and he loved to sing, especially Hank Williams. "Your cheatin' heart" echoed up and down the run. The others shouted obscenities. He shouted them right back. Then Soledad got fed up with Ron's music and threatened to kill him. "Who cares?" Ron said. "I've already got my death sentence." No effort was made to air-condition F. Cell House, and when summer arrived, it baked like a sauna. The inmates stripped to their boxers and huddled in front of the small fans sold at the canteen. It was not unusual to wake up before dawn with the sheets soaked with sweat. A few spent the days completely nude. For some reason, the prison conducted tours of death row. The tourists were usually high school students whose parents and advisors were hoping to scare them away from crime. When the weather was hot, the guards ordered the inmates to get dressed. A tour was coming through. Some complied, others did not. An Indian named Buck Naked preferred the native look and was perpetually nude. He had the rare ability to pass gas on demand, and when the tour groups drew near, his favorite trick was to press his rear cheeks against the bars of his door and discharge a thunderous blast of flatulence. This shocked the young students and disrupted their tours. The guards told him to stop. He refused. His colleagues egged him on, but only during tours. The guards finally hauled him away when visitors arrived. Several others tried imitations, but lacked the talent. Ron just played and sang for the tourists. On July 4, 1988, Ron awoke in a foul mood and never recovered. It was Independence Day, a time for celebrations and parades and such, and he was locked away in a hellhole for a crime he did not commit. Where was his independence? He began yelling and cursing and proclaiming his innocence, and when this prompted catcalls up and down the run, he went crazy. He began throwing everything he could find, books, magazines, toiletries, his small radio, his Bible, clothes. The guards watched and told him to settle down. He cursed them and got louder. Pencils, papers, food from the canteen. Then he grabbed his television and slammed it into the brick wall, shattering it. Finally, he took his cherished guitar and slammed it repeatedly into the bars of his cell door. Most death row inmates took a daily dose of a benign antidepressant called Sinequan. It was supposed to calm nerves and help with sleep. The guards finally convinced Ron to take something stronger, and he became drowsy and quiet. Later in the day, he began cleaning up his cell. Then he called Annette and, in tears, told her about the episode. She visited him later, and things were not pleasant. He shouted into the phone, accused her of not trying to free him, and again demanded that she sell everything and hire a big-time lawyer who could fix this injustice. She asked him to settle down, stop yelling, and when he didn't, she threatened to leave. Over time, she and Renee replaced the television, radio, and guitar. In September 1988, a lawyer from Norman by the name of Mark Barrett drove to McAllister to meet his new client. Mark was one of four lawyers who handled the appeals for indigent defendants in capital cases. The Williamson case had been assigned to him. Barney Ward was out of the picture. Appeals are automatic in capital cases. The necessary notices had been filed. The slow process was underway. Mark explained this to Ron Williamson and listened to his lengthy proclamations of innocence. He was not surprised to hear such talk, and he had not yet studied the transcript of the trial. To assist his new lawyer, Ron handed over a list of all the witnesses who had lied at his trial, then, in minute detail, described to Mark Barrett the nature and extent of their lies. Mark found Ron to be intelligent, rational, clearly aware of his predicament and surroundings. He was articulate and spoke at length and in great detail about the lies the police and prosecution had used against him. He was a little panicky, but that was to be expected. Mark had no idea of Ron's medical history. Mark's father was a minister in the Disciples of Christ denomination, and this bit of background prompted Ron into a long discussion about religion. He wanted Mark to know that he was a devout Christian, had been raised in the church by God-fearing parents, and read his Bible often. He quoted many verses of Scripture, and Mark was impressed. One in particular was troubling him, and he asked Mark for his interpretation. They discussed it thoroughly. It was important for Ron to understand the verse, and he was clearly frustrated by his inability to grasp its meaning. Attorney visits had no time limits, and the clients were anxious to stay out of their cells. They talked for over an hour. Mark Barrett's first impression was that Ron was a fundamentalist, an easy talker, perhaps a bit too slick. As always, he was skeptical of his client's claims of innocence, though his mind was far from closed. He was also handling the appeals for Greg Wilhoit, and he was thoroughly convinced Greg did not kill his wife. Mark knew there were innocent men on death row, and the more he learned about Ron's case, the more he believed him. Chapter 11. Though Dennis Fritz didn't realize it, 12 months in the dungeon of the county jail had helped prepare him for the severe conditions of prison life. He arrived at the Connor Correctional Center in June, in the rear of a van loaded with other new inmates, still dazed and in denial and terrified. It was important to look and act confident, and he worked hard at it. Connor had the reputation as the dump site of medium-security prisons. It was a tough place, tougher than most, and Dennis asked himself over and over how and why he had been randomly assigned to the place. He was herded through the admissions procedures and given the standard lectures about rules and regulations, then assigned to a two-man cell with bunk beds and a window through which he could see the outdoors. Like Ron, he was thankful for the window. He'd gone for weeks in Ada without seeing sunshine. His roommate was a Mexican who spoke little English, and that was fine with Dennis. He spoke no Spanish and wasn't in the mood to learn. The first overwhelming challenge was how to find brief moments of privacy with another human always within arm's reach. Dennis vowed to spend every possible moment working to free himself from his sentence. It would have been easy to give up, the system was so heavily weighted against the inmates, but he was determined to prevail. Connor was overcrowded and known for its violence. There were gangs, killings, beatings, rapes, drugs everywhere, and guards on the take. He quickly found the safer areas and avoided men he thought were trouble. He treated fear as an asset. After a few months, most prisoners unwittingly fell into the routine of the prison and became institutionalized. They lowered their guard, took chances, took safety for granted. It was a good way to get hurt, and Dennis vowed that he would never forget to be afraid. The prisoners were awake by 7 a.m., and all cell doors were opened. They ate in a large cafeteria and could sit anywhere they wished. The whites took one side, the blacks the other, and the Indians and Hispanics were caught in the middle but leaned toward the darker section. The food for breakfast was not bad. Eggs, grits, bacon. Conversation was lively. The men were relieved to have contact with others. Most wanted to work, anything to stay out of the unit where the cells were. Because Dennis had once taught, he was recruited to teach other inmates in the General Equivalency Diploma Program. After breakfast, he went to the classroom and taught until noon. His salary was $7.20 a month. His mother and aunt began sending $50 a month, money they barely scraped together but made a priority. He spent it in the canteen on tobacco, canned tuna, crackers, and cookies. Virtually every inmate smoked, and the great currency was cigarettes. A pack of Marlboros was like a pocketful of cash. Dennis soon found the law library and was pleased to learn that he could study there every day from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. without interruption. He had never picked up a law book, but he was determined to master the research. A couple of the law clerks, other inmates who fancied themselves jailhouse lawyers and were quite knowledgeable, befriended him and taught him how to move through the thick treatises and digests. As always, they charged for their advice. The fees were paid in cigarettes. He began his legal education by reading hundreds of Oklahoma cases, looking for similarities and potential mistakes made during his trial. His appeals would soon start, and he wanted to know as much as his lawyer. He discovered the federal digests and took notes on thousands of cases from throughout the country. Lockdown was from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Heads were counted, reports made. Dinner was over at 7:30, and from then until the next lockdown at 10:15, the inmates were free to roam around the unit, exercise, play cards or dominoes or basketball. Many chose to just hang out, to sit in groups and talk and smoke and kill time. Dennis went back to the law library. His daughter, Elizabeth, was 15, and they maintained a lively correspondence. She was being raised by her maternal grandmother in a stable home with plenty of attention. She believed her father to be innocent, but Dennis always suspected she had some doubt. They swapped letters and talked on the phone at least once a week. Dennis would not allow her to visit him, though. He did not want his daughter near the prison. She would not see him dressed like a convict and living behind razor wire. Wanda Fritz, his mother, traveled to Connor soon after Dennis arrived. Visitation was on Sunday, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., in a room with rows of folding tables and chairs. It was a zoo. 20 or so inmates were admitted at once, and their families were waiting, wives, children, mothers, and fathers. Emotions were high. The children were often rowdy and loud. The men were not handcuffed, and contact was allowed. Contact was exactly what the men wanted, though excessive kissing and groping were prohibited. The trick was to get a fellow inmate to jigger or sidetrack a guard for a few seconds while rabid sex was accomplished. It was not unusual to see a couple slide between two soft drink machines and somehow copulate. Wives sitting placidly at a table often disappeared quickly, ducking under the table for a quick round of oral sex. Fortunately, Dennis was able to hold his mother's attention in the midst of such frenzied activity. But the visit was the most stressful time of the week. He discouraged her from returning. Ron soon began pacing and yelling in his cell. If you weren't crazy when you got to the row, it didn't take long to lose your mind after you arrived. He stood at his door and screamed, "I am innocent! I am innocent!" for hours until he became hoarse. With practice, though, his voice strengthened, and he could shout for longer periods of time. "I did not kill Debbie Carter! I did not kill Debbie Carter!" He memorized the entire transcript of the Ricky Joe Simmons confession, every word, and delivered it at full volume for the benefit of his guards and neighbors. He could also go for hours reciting his trial transcript, pages and pages of the testimony that had sent him to death row. The other inmates wanted to choke him, but at the same time, they marveled at his memory. But they were not impressed at 2 in the morning. Renee received a strange letter from another inmate. It read, in part, "Dear Renee, praise the Lord. This is J. Neal, number 141128. I am writing this on behalf and at the request of your brother, Ron. Ron lives catty-corner to my cell. At times, Ron goes through very difficult stages on a daily basis. I am under the impression that he is on some form of medication to attempt to stabilize and modify his behavior. At best, though, the limitation of the types of medication they will distribute here only works in a marginal capacity at best. Ron's biggest defeat is his low self-esteem, and I believe the people here at OSP tell him he is below par in an IQ scale. His worst times come between 12 a.m. and 4 a.m. At times, spaced periodically, he screams different things at the top of his lungs. This has disturbed many convicts in the vicinity. At first, they tried to reason with him, then to tolerate. But even that has worn thin with many around him, due to the sleepless nights, for sure. I am a Christian, and I pray daily for Ron. I talk to him and listen to him. He loves both you and Annette very much. I am his friend. I have acted in the capacity of a buffer between Ron and the people his yelling bothers by getting up and talking to him until he is calm. God bless you and your family. Sincerely, J. Neal." Neal's friendship with anyone on the row was always doubtful, and his conversion to Christianity was often the topic of conversation. His friends were skeptical. Before prison, he and his boyfriend longed to move to San Francisco to enjoy a more open lifestyle. Since they had no money, they decided to rob a bank, an undertaking with which they had no experience. They picked one in the town of Geronimo, and after they entered it loudly and announced their intentions, things fell apart. In the chaos of the robbery, Neil and his partner fatally stabbed 3 bank tellers, shot 1 customer to death, and wounded 3 others. In the midst of the bloodbath, Neil ran out of bullets, something he realized as he put his revolver to the head of a small child and pulled the trigger. Nothing happened. The child was unharmed, at least physically. The 2 killers escaped with about $20,000 in cash and were soon in San Francisco, where they went on a shopping spree, full-length mink coats, lovely scarves, and such. They threw money around in gay bars and had a decadent time for slightly more than 24 hours. Then they were hauled back to Oklahoma, where Neil was eventually executed. On the row, Neil liked to quote scripture and deliver many sermons, but few listened. On death row, medical attention was not a priority. Every inmate said that the first thing you lose is your health, then your sanity. Ron was seen by a prison doctor who had the benefit of his previous prison records and mental health history. It was noted that he had a long history of drug and alcohol abuse, certainly not a surprise on F. Cell House. He suffered from depression and had been bipolar for at least 10 years. There was some schizophrenia and personality disorder. He was prescribed Melaril again, and it settled him down. Most of the other inmates thought Ron was simply playing the nut role, pretending to be crazy in hopes of somehow walking away from the row. 2 doors down from Greg Wilhoit lived an old inmate named Sonny Hayes. No one was certain how long Sonny had been waiting, but he had arrived there before anyone else. He was pushing 70, in terrible health, and refused to see or speak to anyone. He covered his cell door with newspapers and blankets, kept his lights off, ate only enough to stay alive, never showered, shaved, or cut his hair, never had visitors, and refused to meet with his lawyers. He neither sent nor received mail, made no phone calls, bought nothing from the canteen, ignored his laundry, and had no television or radio. He never left his dark little dungeon, and days could pass with no sound from within. Sonny was completely insane, and since a mentally incompetent person cannot be executed, he was simply rotting away and dying on his own terms. Now there was a new crazy man on the row, though Ron had a hard time convincing others. He was just playing the nut role. One episode, though, got their attention. Ron managed to clog his toilet and flood his cell with 2 inches of water. He stripped naked and began doing belly flops into the pool from his top bunk, yelling incoherently as he did so. The guards finally managed to secure and sedate him. Although there was no air conditioning on F. Cell House, there was a heating system, and winter brought the reasonable expectation of having warm air pumped through the ancient vents. It didn't happen. The cells were frigid. Ice often formed on the inside of the windows during the night, and the heavily bundled inmates stayed in bed as long as possible. The only way to sleep was to layer on all available clothing, both sets of socks, boxers, t-shirts, khakis, work shirts, and anything else a prisoner might be able to afford from the canteen. Extra blankets were luxuries and were not furnished by the state. The food, which was cold in the summertime, was barely edible in winter. The convictions of Tommy Ward and Carl Fontenot were reversed by the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals because their confessions were used against each other at trial, and since neither testified, each was denied the right to confront the other. Had separate trials been given, the constitutional problems would have been avoided. Had the confessions been suppressed, of course, there would have been no convictions. They were taken off the row and sent back to Ada. Tommy was retried in the town of Shawnee in Pottawatomie County. With Bill Peterson and Chris Ross prosecuting once again, and with the judge permitting the jury to see the taped confession, Tommy was again found guilty and rewarded with another death sentence. During his retrial, his mother was driven to the courthouse each day by Annette Hudson. Carl was retried in the town of Holdenville in Hughes County. He, too, was found guilty and given a death sentence. Ron was ecstatic at their reversals, then dismayed at their subsequent convictions. His own direct appeal was slowly inching through the system. His case had been reassigned within the appellate public defender's office. Due to the increasing number of capital cases, more lawyers were hired. Mark Barrett was overworked and needed to unload a case or two. He was also anxiously awaiting a ruling from the Court of Criminal Appeals in Greg Wilhoit's case. That court was notoriously tough on defendants, but Mark was convinced Greg would get a new trial. Ron's new lawyer was Bill Luker, and his brief argued vigorously that Ron had not received a fair trial. He attacked the representation of Barney Ward and claimed Ron had received ineffective assistance of counsel, usually the first argument in a capital case. Chief among Barney's sins was his failure to raise the issue of Ron's mental incompetence. None of his medical records were in evidence. Luker researched Barney's mistakes, and the list became long. He assailed the methods and tactics of the police and the prosecutor, and his brief grew lengthy. He also challenged the rulings of Judge Jones, allowing Ron's dream confession to be heard by the jury, ignoring the numerous Brady violations by the prosecution, and in general failing to protect Ron's right to a fair trial. The vast majority of Bill Luker's clients were clearly guilty. His job was to make sure they received a fair hearing on appeal. Ron's case was different, though. The more he researched and the more questions he asked, the more Luker became convinced that it was an appeal he could win. Ron was a very cooperative client with strong views that he was ready to share with his lawyer. He called frequently and wrote rambling letters. His comments and observations were generally helpful. At times, his recall of the details of his medical history was astounding. He dwelled on the confession of Ricky Joe Simmons and considered its exclusion from his trial a major travesty. He wrote Luker, "Dear Bill, you know I think Ricky Simmons killed Debbie. He must have, or he wouldn't have confessed to it. Now, Bill, I've been going through physical hell. I think it's only fair for Simmons to pay for what he did and for me to go free. They don't want to release his confession to you because they know you'd put it in my brief and immediately win me a new trial. So for God's sakes, tell them sons of a bitches you want his confession. Your friend, Ron." With plenty of free time, Ron developed an active correspondence, especially with his sisters. They knew how important the letters were, and they found time to write back. Money was usually an issue. He was unable to eat the prison food and preferred to buy whatever he could from the canteen. He wrote to Renee and said, in part, "Renee, I know Annette sends me a little money, but my misery is increasing. I've got Carl Fontenot here, and he doesn't have anyone sending him anything. Could you please send me a little extra, even if it's $10? Love, Ronnie." Just before his first Christmas on the row, he wrote Renee and said in part, "Renee, hey, thanks for sending the money. It'll go for specific needs, mainly guitar strings and coffee. I got 5 Christmas cards this year, including yours. Christmas can give some good feelings. Renee, the $20 really came at a good time. I had just borrowed some money to buy some guitar strings from a friend of mine, and I was going to pay him back out of the $50 a month Annette sends. That would have cut me a little short. I know $50 may sound like a lot, but I've been giving, sharing with a guy here whose mother can't afford to send anything. She did send him $10, but that's the first money he's received since September, when I moved near him. I give him coffee, cigarettes, etc. Poor fella. Today's Friday, so you all will be opening gifts tomorrow. I hope everybody gets what they need. Kids sure grow up fast. I'm going to start crying if I don't get myself together. Tell everybody I love them, Ronnie." It was difficult to think of Ronnie having good feelings during the holidays. The tedium of death row was horrible enough, but to be cut off from his family brought a level of pain and desperation he could not handle. Early in the spring of 1989, he began slipping badly. The pressure, the drudgery, the sheer frustration of being sent to hell for a crime he did not commit consumed him, and he fell apart. He began cutting his wrists and attempting suicide. He was very depressed and wanted to die. The wounds were superficial but left scars. There were several episodes of this, and he was watched closely by the guards. When the wrist cutting didn't work, he managed to start a fire with his mattress and let it drip over his extremities. The burns were treated and eventually healed. More than once, he was put on a suicide watch. On July 12, 1989, he wrote to Renee, "Dear Renee, I'm going through so much suffering. I've burned some tissue and got several second and third degree burns. The pressure here is immense. Never getting to go anywhere when the suffering is intolerable. Renee, I've had headaches. I've banged into the concrete. I've gotten down on the floor and banged my head against the concrete. I've hit myself in the face till I was so sore the next day from the punches. Everybody here is stuck here like sardines. I know for a fact this is the most suffering I've ever had to endure. The magic to the problem and its solution is money. I'm talking about never having anything to eat that's worth a shit. This food is like living on K-rations on some damn God-forbidden island. People here are poor, but I've been so hungry that I've had to ask for a morsel to stop the craving. I've lost weight. There's so much suffering here. Please help me. Ron." In one prolonged depressive bout, Ron stopped communication with everyone and withdrew completely until the guards found him curled into a fetal position on his bed. He would respond to nothing. Then, on September 29th, Ron cut his wrists again. He was taking his medication sporadically, was talking nonstop about suicide, and was finally deemed to be a threat to himself. He was moved out of F. Cell House and transferred to Eastern State Hospital in Veneta. Upon his admission, his chief complaint was, "I have suffered unjustified abuse." At Eastern State, he was first seen by a staff physician, a Dr. Lazariga, who saw a 36-year-old with a history of drugs and alcohol, unkempt, unshaven, with long graying hair and a mustache, in shabby prison dress, with burn marks on his legs and scars on his arms, scars he made sure the doctor noticed. He freely admitted many of his misdeeds, but adamantly denied killing Debbie Carter. The injustice from which he was suffering had caused him to lose hope and want to die. For the next 3 months, Ron was a patient at Eastern State. His medication was stabilized. He was seen by various doctors, a neurologist, a psychologist, several psychiatrists. It was noted more than once that he was unstable emotionally, had a low tolerance for frustration, was self-centered with low self-esteem, was detached at times, and had a tendency to explode quickly. The mood swings were wild and remarkable. He was demanding and over time became aggressive with the staff and other patients. This aggression could not be tolerated, and Ron was discharged and sent back to death row. Dr. Lazariga prescribed lithium carbonate, Navane, and Cogentin, a drug used primarily to treat symptoms of Parkinson's disease, but sometimes used to reduce shakiness and restlessness caused by tranquilizers. Back at Big Mac, a prison guard by the name of Savage was brutally attacked by Michael Patrick Smith, a death row inmate generally regarded as the most dangerous killer in the prison. Smith rigged a knife, or a shank, to the end of a broom handle and thrust it through the bean hole as the guard was serving him lunch. The shank went into his chest and heart, but Officer Savage miraculously survived. 2 years earlier, Smith had stabbed a fellow inmate. The attack occurred not on death row, but on D Cell House, where Smith was being held for disciplinary reasons. Nonetheless, the prison officials decided that a new, state-of-the-art death row facility was required. The attack was well publicized and prompted funding for the new unit. Plans were drawn up for H Unit, which from the outset was designed to maximize security and control while providing inmates and staff with a safe, modern environment in which to live and work. It would have 200 cells on two floors, running along four quads. From the beginning, the design of H Unit was driven by the prison staff. In the tense atmosphere following the attack on Officer Savage, the staff was given enormous input into the creation of a non-contact facility. Early in the design phase, 35 prison employees met with the Tulsa architects hired by the Department of Corrections. Though no death row inmate had ever escaped from McAllister, the designers of H Unit adopted the dramatic plan of putting the entire unit underground. After 2 years on death row, Ron's mental health was seriously deteriorating. His noise, yelling, screaming, cursing at all hours of the day and night, grew worse. His behavior grew even more desperate. His temper would explode over nothing, and he would launch into a fit of cursing and throwing things. In another fit, he would spit for hours into the hall. He once spat on a guard. But when he began throwing his feces through the bars, it was time to take him away.
"He's slinging shit again!"
a guard yelled, and everybody ducked for cover. When things were clear, they rushed him and hauled him away, back to Vanita for another round of evaluation. He spent a month at Eastern State in July and August 1990. He was again seen by Dr. Lazariga, who diagnosed the same problems as before. After 3 weeks, Ron began demanding to be returned to death row. He was concerned about his appeal and felt that he could work on it better at McAllister, where at least they had a law library. His medications had been adjusted, he seemed to be stabilized, and so he was sent back. Chapter 12. After 13 years of frustration, Oklahoma finally managed to untangle the appeals process and schedule an execution. The unlucky inmate was Charles Troy Coleman, a white man who'd killed 3 people and had been on death row for 11 years. He was the leader of a small faction that was usually stirring up trouble on the row, and many of his neighbors were not upset by the prospect of Chuck finally getting the needle. Most of the men, though, knew that when the killings finally started, there would be no turning back. The Coleman execution was a media event, and the press converged outside Big Mac. There were candlelight vigils and interviews with victims, protesters, ministers, anyone who happened to walk by. As the hours passed, the excitement increased. Greg Wilhoit and Coleman had become friends, though they argued bitterly over the death penalty. Ron was still in favor of it, though he swayed back and forth. He was not fond of Coleman, who, not surprisingly, had become frustrated with Ron's noisy presence. The row was quiet and heavily secured the night Coleman was executed. The circus was outside the prison, where the press counted down the minutes as if a new year were approaching. Greg was in his cell, watching it all on television. Just after midnight, the news arrived. Charles Troy Coleman was dead. Several inmates clapped and cheered. Most sat quietly in their cells. Some were in prayer. Greg's reaction was completely unexpected. He was suddenly overcome with emotion and bitter at those who cheered the news. His friend was gone. The world was not now a safer place. Not a single future murderer would be deterred. He knew killers and what prompted them to act. If the victim's family was pleased, then they were far from closure. Greg had been raised in a Methodist church and now studied the Bible every day. Didn't Jesus teach forgiveness? If killing was wrong, then why was the state allowed to kill? By whose authority was the execution carried out? He'd been hit with these arguments before, many times, but now they resonated from a different source. The death of Charles Coleman was a dramatic revelation for Greg. At that moment, he flipped 180 degrees, never to return to his eye-for-an-eye beliefs. Later, he offered these thoughts to Ron, who confessed that he shared many of them. The next day, though, Ron was an ardent supporter of the death penalty who wanted Ricky Joe Simmons dragged in off the streets of Ada and shot on the spot. The prosecution of Ron Williamson was vindicated on May 15, 1991, when the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals unanimously affirmed his conviction and death sentence. The court, in an opinion written by Judge Gary Lumpkin, found several mistakes with the trial, But the overwhelming evidence against the defendant far outweighed any of the trifling errors committed by Barney, the cops, Peterson, and Judge Jones. The court spent little time discussing exactly what evidence had been so overwhelming. Bill Luker called Ron with the bad news, and he took it well enough. Ron had studied the briefs, talked to Bill many times, and been cautioned against optimism. On the same date, Dennis Fritz received the same news from the same court. Again, the justices found several mistakes in his trial, but were evidently swayed by the overwhelming evidence against Dennis. He had not been impressed with the brief filed by his appellate lawyer, and he was not surprised when his conviction was upheld. After 3 years in the prison library, Dennis believed that he knew the statutes and cases better than his attorney. He was disappointed, but did not give up. Like Ron, he had other arguments to make in other courts. Quitting was not an option. But unlike Ron, Dennis was now on his own. Since he was not on death row, there were no indigent lawyers available for him. But the Court of Criminal Appeals was not always a rubber stamp for the prosecution. Much to Mark Barrett's delight, he received the news on April 16, 1991, that a new trial had been ordered for Greg Wilhoit. The court found it impossible to ignore the miserable job done by George Briggs in defending Greg and ruled that he did not receive adequate representation. When you're on trial for your life, hire either the best lawyer in town or the worst. Greg had unwittingly hired the worst, and now he had a new trial. When an inmate was to be removed from his cell and taken off the row for any reason, there was never an explanation. Guards simply showed up with orders to get dressed, quickly. Greg knew he'd won his appeal, though, and when the guards arrived at his cell door, the big day had come. "Pack your stuff," one of them said, and it was time to leave. In a couple of minutes, he stuffed his entire collection of assets into one cardboard box, then walked away with his escorts. Ron had been moved to the other end of the run, and there was no chance of a farewell. As Greg left McAllister, his thoughts were of the friend he was leaving behind. When he arrived at the jail in Osage County, a bail hearing was quickly arranged by Mark Barrett. With a capital murder charge still pending and a trial date yet to be set, Greg was not exactly a free man. Instead of the usual exorbitant bond that was impossible to make, the judge set bail at $50,000, a sum Greg's parents and sisters quickly covered. After 5 years in jail, four on death row, Greg was free, never to return to a prison cell. Construction of H Unit had begun in 1990. Virtually everything was made of concrete. Floors, walls, ceilings, bunks, bookshelves. To eliminate the chance of shanks being produced, no metal was included in the plans. There were plenty of bars and some glass, but not in the cells. Everything there was concrete. When the structure was complete, it was covered with dirt. Energy efficiency was the official reason. Natural light and ventilation were extinguished. When H Unit opened in November 1991, the prison celebrated its new state-of-the-art death house by throwing a party. Big shots were invited, ribbons were cut, the prison band was forced to play a few tunes. Tours were given. The future inhabitants were still over in the big house, a quarter of a mile away. Guests were given the opportunity to pay to sleep one night on a brand new concrete bunk in the cell of their choice. After the party, and to work out the kinks, some medium security prisoners were moved in first and watched closely to see what mischief they could create. When H Unit proved sturdy, functional, and escape-proof, it was time to send in the bad boys from F Cell House. The complaining and bitching started immediately. There were no windows, no chance of outside light, no hope of fresh air. Double celling was implemented, and the cells were too small for two men. The concrete bunks were too hard and only 36 inches apart. A stainless steel toilet sink was wedged between them, so that a bowel movement was a shared event. The layout of the pods was such that most of the daily chatter, the lifeblood for the prisoners, was cut off. As a non-contact facility, H Unit was designed not only to keep the guards away from inmates, but to isolate the prisoners themselves. The food was worse than on F Cell House. The yard, the most cherished area at the old place, was nothing but a concrete box much smaller than a tennis court. Its walls were 18 feet tall, and the entire area was covered with a thick grate that blocked out whatever light could penetrate the sun dome. It was impossible to see green grass. The new concrete had not been sealed or painted. Concrete dust was everywhere. It piled up in the corners of the cells. It clung to the walls, settled on the floors, hung in the air, and of course was inhaled by the inmates. Attorneys visiting their clients often left coughing and rasping because of the dust. The state-of-the-art ventilation system was closed, meaning there was no outside circulation at all. This was tolerable until the power went out, which happened often while the bugs were being worked out of the system. Leslie Delk, an indigent defense lawyer assigned to Ron Williamson, discussed the problems in a letter to a colleague who had sued the prison. "The food situation is horrible, and almost every client I have has lost weight. One client has lost 90 pounds in 10 months. I have communicated this with the prison, but of course they tell me he is fine, etc. One thing discovered on a recent trip to the infirmary was that the food is brought over from the old prison where it is prepared behind the walls. When it arrives at H Unit, there are inmates, shock incarceration guys, I think, that serve it up. These guys are told that they can have whatever is left. So the portions the death row inmates are now receiving are about half of what the rest of the prison receives. It is my understanding that there is little or no DOC supervision of the food as it is put on the trays for the death row guys. All my clients have complained that the food is always cold now, and that it is so poorly prepared that the men are sick from it, and the quantities are so low that most people are forced to purchase food from the canteen so they can get enough to eat. This is, of course, the prison store that charges whatever they want for the foods they offer, usually much higher than we could purchase from a grocery store. Also, many of my clients have no family to help support them, so they go without." H Unit was a shock to the inmates. After hearing rumors for 2 years about a new, modern $11 million facility, they were stunned when they moved into an underground prison with less space and more restrictions than F Cell House. Ron hated H Unit. His roommate was Rick Rojum, a resident of the Row since 1985 and a calming influence. Rick was a Buddhist who spent hours in meditation and also enjoyed playing the guitar. Privacy was impossible in their cramped cell. They rigged a blanket from the ceiling and between the beds in a lame effort to withdraw into their own worlds. Rojum was worried about Ron. He had lost interest in reading. His mind and conversation could not stay on one subject. He was medicated at times, but far from getting proper treatment. He would sleep for hours, then pace around the tiny cell for an entire night, mumbling incoherently or chanting about one of his delusions. Then he would stand at the door and scream in agony. Since they were together 23 hours a day, Rick was watching his cellmate go insane, and he couldn't help him. Ron lost 90 pounds after moving into H Unit. His hair turned gray, and he looked like a ghost. Annette was waiting one day in the visitor's room when she saw the guards lead a wiry old man with long, stringy gray hair and a beard into the room. "Who is that?" she thought. "Her brother." She said, "When I saw them bring this man with long hair and just a skinny, horrible, emaciated-looking man that they brought to visit me that I would not have recognized if I met him on the street, I came home and I wrote the warden asking him to have Ron checked for AIDS because he looked so gauntish, and knowing the stories you hear about prisons, I asked them to check him for AIDS." The warden wrote back and assured her Ronnie did not have AIDS. She fired off another letter and complained about the food, the high prices in the canteen, and the fact that the profits from the canteen went into a fund to help buy exercise equipment for the guards. In 1992, a psychiatrist named Ken Foster was hired by the prison and soon met Ron Williamson. He found him to be disheveled, disoriented, out of touch with reality, thin, gray, frail, emaciated, in poor physical condition. It was obvious to Dr. Foster, as it should have been to the prison officials, that something was wrong. Ron's mental condition was even worse than his physical. His outbursts and explosions were far beyond normal prison clamor, and it was no secret among the guards and staff that he had lost contact with reality. Dr. Foster witnessed several bouts of the maniacal screaming and noted three general themes. One, that Ron was innocent. Two, that Ricky Joe Simmons had confessed to the murder and should be prosecuted. And three, that Ron was in great physical pain, usually in his chest, and he was afraid he was about to die. Though his symptoms were obvious and extreme, the records reviewed by Dr. Foster indicated that Ron had been receiving no mental health treatment for a long time. The denial of medication for a person as sick as Ron normally results in the onset of psychotic symptoms. Dr. Foster wrote, "The psychotic reaction and the accompanying deterioration are worsened when a person is under the multiple stresses which accompany being in a death row environment and having the knowledge that you are scheduled to die." The GAF scale, as set forth in authoritative mental health manuals, considers imprisonment a catastrophic stressor. It was impossible to speculate how much worse the catastrophe might be for an innocent person. Dr. Foster decided Ron needed better medications in a better environment. Ron would always be mentally ill, but improvements were possible, even for a death row inmate. However, Dr. Foster soon learned that helping sick and condemned prisoners was a very low priority. He spoke to James Saffel, a regional director with the Department of Corrections, and to Dan Reynolds, the warden at McAllister. Both were familiar with Ron Williamson and his problems, and both had more important things to worry about. Ken Foster, though, proved to be a rather stubborn, independent sort who disliked bureaucratic decisions and actually wanted to help his patients. He kept reporting to Saffel and Reynolds and made sure they knew the details of Ron's serious mental and physical problems. He insisted on meeting with Reynolds at least once a week to review the status of his patients. Ron was always mentioned. And he spoke daily to a deputy warden, gave the routine updates, and made sure the summaries were passed on to the warden. Repeatedly, Dr. Foster explained to those who ran the prison that Ron was not getting the medicines he needed and that he was deteriorating mentally and physically because of inadequate treatment. He was especially incensed that Ron would not be transferred to the Special Care Unit, or SCU, a building within view of H Unit. Inmates who exhibited serious mental problems were routinely moved into the SCU, the only facility at McAllister designed for such treatment. However, the DOC had a long-standing policy that denied death row inmates access to the SCU. The official reason was vague, but many capital defense lawyers suspected the policy was in place to help speed along executions. If a severely disturbed death row inmate was properly evaluated, he might be found to be incompetent, thus thwarting a trip to the chamber. The policy had been challenged many times, but remained intractable. Ken Foster challenged it again. He explained repeatedly to Saffel and Reynolds that he could not adequately treat Ron Williamson without placing him at the SCU, where he could monitor his condition and regulate his medication. Often, his explanations were pointed, heated, and intense. But Dan Reynolds proved stubbornly resistant to the idea of moving Ron and saw no need to improve his treatment. "Don't bother with death row inmates," Reynolds said. "They're going to die anyway." Dr. Foster's appeals on behalf of Ron became so bothersome that Warden Reynolds locked him out of the prison. When the lockout ended, Dr. Foster resumed his efforts to move Ron to the SCU. It took 4 years. After his direct appeal was over, Ron's case entered post-conviction relief, the next stage in which he was allowed to present evidence that was not offered at trial. As was the practice at that time, Bill Luker transferred the file to Leslie Delk with the Appellate Public Defender's Office. Her first priority was obtaining better medical treatment for her client. She saw Ron once on F-cell house and realized he was a very sick man. After he was transferred to H Unit,